Okay, I'll try again to do it on both the audio and the video. I want to say a few words about Tubach, which is coming up this week for Mishpachas Stefanski, as always, and thanking them. And maybe I'll get somebody for the rest of the week also. We'll see. This week is Tubach, right? In other words, today is 11, I guess. So figure what, Shabbos, I guess, I suppose. It's Tubach, it's my anniversary, actually. And it's a very interesting theme, especially in the context of what's going in Israel now, but also throughout Jewish history, because it's, in a certain sense, but not so simple, the antithesis of Tisha B'Av. What Tisha B'Av is also about the Sinas Chinam and the Pirud, the splits and the fights and the civil wars, actually, that happened among the Jews, which I've spoken about ad nauseum, unfortunately. But you'd say that Tu B'Av is the antithesis of that. Excuse me, because what do you have on Tu B'Av? Yom Shehutu Shvatim Lo Bezeh Bezeh, where they allow the tribes to marry each other, you know, like the B'no Slavchad, post B'no Slavchad episode, you weren't supposed to marry someone another tribe. It's this idea of tribalism, which goes back to the dawn of Jewish history, as we shall see, and had to do, of course, with each tribe getting its own land within Israel. Therefore, they don't want any interlopers coming in and marrying somebody local, like a B'no Slavchad, and then taking away land from the tribe. So everything's very narrow, anal, you know, it's very possessive, and they couldn't marry each other. And Tu B'Av is when that changed. So on the face of it, you give a nice rabbinical sermon, I'm sure some will, you know, that the antidote to Tisha B'Av is Tu B'Av. Because what happened on Tisha B'Av and what happens today in Jewish history, very tribalistic, very siloed, as the current word is. And this group keeps itself, and that group is itself, and they fight with each other, and so on and so forth. That's true. That's certainly true. And Tu B'Av is when the Hutru Shvatim Lo Bezeh Bezeh. So it's like we would say today, when the modern Orthodox and the Black Hat can get together, something like that, I don't know, you know, Satmar and Lubavitch, Sephardim and Ashkenazim, and so forth and so on. And that's only within the Frum world. Imagine Frum and not Frum, and like that. Yom Shehutu Shvatim Lo Bezeh. I'm telling you right now, if I had a big liberal congregation, you could do a lot of, get a lot of credit with that kind of speech. It's always PC. It's not so simple, though, okay? Not so simple. The other one is Pilegish Begiva. Now, there's a bunch of them, but I'm concentrating on three that have to do with my theme, namely unity and disunity, because that, I think, is the central theme of what Tu B'Av is all about. If you paid me, you could shoe it into... the story about the Mesei Midbar dying, you know, from the Meraglim, that was also a big period. And as you know, they stopped dying. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. They stopped dying in the desert. But, and of course, the boys and the girls dancing together, which is strange, but nevertheless, it's one big kind of Achdus business, right? Now, they didn't say, think about what I'm about to say. They didn't say like this, yeshivish guys over here for yeshivish girls, and modern guys over here for modern girls, and Chiloni guys over here for Chiloni. It wasn't like that. It was all tamisht, right? So that, again, is a big statement of Achdus. I don't know how they pulled it off, aside from the other aspects of that. It wouldn't fly today, but... and we're talking about, you know, the Frum of the Frum in those days. L'hoi yom tov l'Yisrael ketubav. As we know, it's in the Mishnah, as everybody knows, the end of Tinus. And, you know, so it's BJJ and what do you call it? Lakewood and this, everybody. So it is strange, but nevertheless, it's a kind of an Achdus type of business. So there is obviously, I mean, I wasn't there, but they're replicating in some sense, Yom Shehutu Shvatim Lo Bezeh Bezeh, right? In a different way. That's one aspect. The second one is Pilegish Begiva, as you know, when they allowed people to marry the tribe in Yemen, which was on the point of extermination as a result of the civil war that ensued after the terrible incident of the Peleg Shvigiva. Everybody knows that story also. And finally, it's Hoshea ben Elo, that the day they took down the Berlin Wall, or better yet, the patrols, because it says that Yeram ben Nevat, as we all know the story, didn't want anybody to go to the base of Migdash. For his own personal political reasons, he thought it would undermine the foundations of his kingdom. Maybe it would have. And he was the king of the 10 tribes, as we call him colloquially. And usually the way I say it is, he put up a a long fence, or the equivalent of a fence, across Israel, in other words, from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River, from the river to the sea, and nobody could go, or he could only go with great difficulty. Now, I mean, theoretically, as I always point out, if somebody from the north wanted over the several hundred years that this Berlin Wall was up to go to the south and see the Beis Hamikdash, it could be done, for example, but it did a huge pain, and therefore nobody did it, or hardly anybody did it. You could just think about what I'm about to say. Suppose you live in Akko or Haifa, that area, and you want to, for whatever reason, go to Shaul Shogun. Let's just say you did. And you live in the time of Yerovam or his successors, right? Basha and the house of Achav and the house of Yehu and so forth. Have several hundred years. And you really wanted to go. First of all, maybe you could sneak through. But besides that, you could do it. How should I put it? You take a ship and you go, for example, to the Philistines, to Gaza, assuming you could do that. It's not that far from Akko to Gaza. Agreed? From Yafo. Yafo was also in the northern kingdom. That's where Jonah departed. And Jonah was in the north, right? He's the prophet of the time of Rome II. So you could think about what I'm saying. You could hire a ship, get out of the ship, and go from Yafo, for example, to Gaza, or to Ashkelon, one of those places, which was Plishtim held, because at the time of the Bible, the Philistines held their own territory. Like today, the Gaza Strip was always giving us trouble. And then it's not so hard. You travel through the Philistine territory and you're already in Yehuda. Look at the map. And you're not that far from Yerushalayim. So it could be done. But the average guy out there, especially with a family and so forth, not going to do that. Alternatively, you could go cross the Jordan River and go through Moab and Ammon or something like that and cross the Dead Sea. You know what I mean? In other words, it was possible, but it's difficult. And that's enough. And therefore, for hundreds of years, nobody from the north, or hardly anybody from the north, went south. I think they say Jonah did, and maybe somebody else, I forget who. And Eliyahu HaNavi, as you know, did that because he was in the north. And after the encounter, him and Jezebel, he travels eventually to Beersheba. And then from Beersheba, he just did the Haftarah not long ago, from Beersheba to Mount Sinai. So that means he obviously somehow or other crossed the border, I don't know how, from the north to the south. And he did it successfully. And what do you call it? And he came to the king of Yehuda. Did he stop in the Beis Hamikdash along the way? Basically, you know, that's a nice question to throw out there. But we'll never know, at least as far as I'm aware. There's no source that discusses that, to the best of my knowledge. But it could be done. But for 99.9%, it was effective. However, just to be fair about it, the Lashonas you have here in the Agadah are very often tzimished, confused, especially when it gets to the Talmud Bavli and this, the Toh Sofrim and all that kind of stuff with which the Talmud Bavli abounds, unfortunately. And so it's not Pardesos. It says Yoram Ben Nehoshi Pardesos. I usually read Pardesos Orchard. So Orchard would be another way of saying wooden barriers, right? But it's really, if you look at the original source in the Yerushalmi, you check it out in Steinsaltz, for example, you see it's Presidios. It's not Pardesos. I can understand that whoever wrote it out in the text of the Talmud that we have probably never heard of Presidios, which is Greek for patrols, and put in Pardes. He's must have figured it's Pardosios. That's how it works when you get to these Greek and Latin words. You know, like the Presidio in the West Coast is patrol. So what it means is that they set up border patrols. And this is sad what I'm about to say. So when Yoram ben Nevat established a Mishmar HaGvul, the same way, ironically, the State of Israel has had a Mishmar HaGvul ever since 1948. And ever since 1948, if you know what I'm talking about, there have been constant terrorist attacks and crossings of the Israeli border, especially before 67, when they didn't have defensible borders. I'm not referring to October 7th. That's a special case. Okay? That's a special case. But I'm talking about, you know, let's say, as I said, from 48 to 67 or something like that, when the borders were not really defensible, you know, that the old green line, as they call it. And the result was that the constant were Arab infiltrators, as they used to call them in those days, and things like this. And therefore, Israel has to build up a strong patrol. So they've tried to do their best in terms of Mishmar HaGvul ever since 48, and certainly lately. And by the way, the Druze that we talking about lately in the news are always very heavily enrolled in the border patrol. So we're Bedouins, by the way, and but also Jews. And here the sad part is, it wasn't to keep infiltrators out. It was like Soviet Russia, to keep your own people in. You get it? What were the border patrols, the presidios, that were set up by Yoram Ben Nebat? To make sure that nobody from the north travels to the south. So it's like Russia, like China, like these dictatorships, where the border patrols make sure nobody escapes from the country, as it were. That's very sad. And that went on for hundreds of years. So maybe Eliyahu HaNavi crossed in between. You know, let me put it this way. It is possible to escape the border patrols, right? You know, smugglers. Maybe there was such a thing. I'm just speculating here. Maybe over the hundreds of years, very likely what I'm saying is true. There were smugglers and speculators who, for the right price, could sneak you over the border, and you could go to the base of Migdash, something like that, and maybe sneak back. Basically, you know, it's very likely something like that happened. We don't have any evidence of that. But it's a minority phenomenon. By and large, people stayed away. And this went for hundreds of years, until in Tu B'Av, the last king of the north, much, much later, Hoshea ben Ela, was Mevatel the Presidios, if you get the right Girsa, which means he canceled the border patrol. And from then on, the border was open. If you want to cross, it was open border, okay? He figured by that time, it was 2 minutes before 12. The kingdom of the north was about to go under. He was hoping, of course, it wasn't. By the time Hoshea ben Ela became king of the north, half of the north was gone because it happened in two scoops. First, the king of Asher, was it? Tiglath-Pileser, I think. Famous Assyrian king carried off like the Galil and the Aver Yarding. And then later on, Shalmaneser and Sargon, whoever it was, it's not clear. That's a historical conundrum of its own, but I'm not going to go into that. He finished them off. And he carried off the rest of the 10 tribes. So in the middle of that was Hoshea ben Ela. And he figured the heck with it, might as well take down the or remove the border patrols. And that happened on Tu B'Av. And as we'll see, it had unintended consequences. But if Chazal, in their wisdom, ordained that Chamisha Sevaob should be a holiday, at least no Tachna, at least. I'm not getting into the nitty-gritty discussions today. If you're interested, those of you who are halachically, technically oriented, is a Magen Avraham and elders, is it a Simcha, is it a Yontif, is it a this, is it that? I don't want to get into that. But if they celebrate this as a date, they considered at least the fact that at least at 5 minutes to 12, they kind of did Teshuvah, but it was too late. Okay, so those are the basic elements, not all the elements, but the basic elements that I think of when you get to Tu B'Av. Okay, Tu B'Av. Now, the interesting part, I mean, you could be, what's right, where you could be optimistic or pessimistic. You can always say the glass is half full, the glass is half empty. I'm naturally of the pessimistic mode, it's just my nature. And I think the Musar Haskel is the pessimistic side, and I'll tell you what I mean. I just laid out before you three items. Yom Shehutu Shvatim Lo Bozeh Bozeh, that's number one. The day of Pelegish Begiva, and they allowed the tribe Binyamin to survive, number two. And the removal of the patrol, the border patrols, that were originally set up by Yoram Ben Nevat, that's number three. A, B, and C. In none of these cases, although it was a good move, in none of these cases do you see that the attempt to repair the damage was entirely successful. But rather, I would argue, you see, the glass remained half empty, meaning even after these steps were taken, it wasn't great. In other words, like the old thing, when you say Lashon Hara, let's say you're good at Lashon Hara. I know a lot of people are good at Lashon Hara. In fact, I'll give you a couple days. if you say Lashon Hara, even if a person goes afterwards and apologizes, all the rest of it, very hard to make it go away. We all know that, right? The damage has been done. Let's put it that way. Even if somebody called me up for a shiva call, for a shidduch call. Ooh, there's a Freudian slip. Even if somebody called for a shidduch call, and let's say I said something bad. I'll just make it up. And then later on, I called and fixed it. You know, I said I was under the impression this guy was a bank robber. Turns out he's not a bank robber. I made a mistake. The effect would still be there. You understand? The effect, they would still be there. Even though they discovered later on he wasn't a bank robber. But, you know, you put the poison out there. That's how it goes. So with sinas chinam or pirud or machloikis, that's how it goes. It can be fixed, but not great. So, for example, we find, at least to my mind, that although Yom Shehutru, Shvatim, Lo, Zeb, Zeb, that the tribes could marry with each other after this, but it doesn't seem that they did. And I'm always reminded of that Mandamar or Pirish that says that Yiftach, we're told, in the time of the judges, was the son of a Zona. Pashim Shad is he was the son of a prostitute. But it's a Chazal or somebody that says, no, his mother was called a Zona because she married somebody from another tribe. It's not a crime to marry somebody from another tribe. Excuse me. You see, once the stigma was there for a short while, at the time of Bnos Lavchad, it became like you're betraying your tribe. You see? So it's hard to undo the damage that was done. And the tribalism remained very powerful even after, you know, the legal side of it was taken away. The other thing is Pelegish Vegiba. Here it's very tricky. What happened to Pelegish Vegiba? That this lady was gang raped to death. As they blamed the tribe Binyamin. Binyamin would not give up the perpetrators. We all know the story. And the other 12 tribes declared war on Binyamin. And the end of the story, and after ups and downs, Binyamin was decisively defeated and came out wiped out. You read the pasuk and it says they went on a berserk fury. The Jews did. This is Jews to Jews. They went on a berserk fury and did like October 7th. They killed the men, women, and children, even the behemoths. I don't have the pasuk in front of me, but look it up in the book of Shoftim, and you'll see they killed like everything. They went wild and nuts. And the area of Binyamin was not that large, so they could do very effective about it. There was only a few hundred men left surviving. Right? We remember this. And then everybody had sworn that they wouldn't marry their daughters Binyamin, so they really wanted to exterminate them. Ad kedekach, that, you know, they wouldn't let anybody marry with them and they kill them all the rest of it. And then they had a change of heart. Okay? So the plain way of understanding a change of heart is that they had a second thought because reality hit them in the solar plexus. In other words, we're going to wipe out a whole shevet of Klal Yisrael. That's not good. We went too far. We were all in a rage, and Binyamin really ticked us off, and especially when he won the battle in the beginning, and et cetera, like everybody knows from the story. But we went too far. We don't want to wipe out an entire shevet. And therefore, they came up with a shtick, which is, we won't give our daughters here, but, you know, be Sadie Hawkins Day. We'll let them go and dance, and, you know, and the Benjaminites will, as they say, you know, unofficially go, each one grab a girl, and that's how they repopulated the tribe of Benjamin. That's what they say. Okay, and that's, I guess, the regular way of reading the story. I always point out that I've pointed that in the past, that I'm sure none of the Benjaminites had trouble recruiting a wife. You think the opposite. The whole tribe had been wiped out. So look on a map, Chalukas Haaretz, and see the area of Binyamin, which wasn't large, but it was Epis, right? Bigger than Rhode Island. And if there are only 400 or 600 survivors total, I'm going to get a lot of land. I hate to say it, but, you know, I'm going to get a lot of land. If I'm one of the 600 survivors, so instead of getting, for argument's sake, you know, 10 acres, then I'm going to get 500 acres because all the others are dead. And we're the only Yarshim, and we inherit the tribe. So every girl that married one of the Benjaminites, she became a balabasta, a big piece of karka. You understand? In other words, they got rich. Because in those days, land was wealth, right? And crops and all the rest of it. And that's what they did. King Saul comes from that. You know, we've talked about that in the past. So it's interesting. On the other hand, in the Yerushalmi, they put it in a different way, which is weird. And in the Yerushalmi, you see that unlike the nice story that I just laid out for you, where all the tribes got together and said, had second thoughts, and they said, maybe we went too far. We didn't want a whole Sheva to be exterminated. That would be terrible, catastrophe, et cetera, et cetera. There were debates. And there was those that say, wipe them out. Go for it, baby. Except that they seem to have been overruled. So in other words, here you have the 12 tribes of Israel, because there's 13 tribes of Levi altogether. And they're thinking, you know, what to do with Binyamin. And many people said, the heck with them, take them down. They did the Peleg Shagiva, they don't deserve to live. You'll tell me, how can you do it to all shave it? It's not so pushy. Look at the Yerushalmi. I have my trusty, nice Yerushalmi here with Hamor, I guess, with all the Kahati stuff, so to speak, at the bottom. And in the back, they have Ein Yaakov HaShalim. And listen to this. It's a short passage in Tainus. At the end of Masechtas Tainus in the Yerushalmi. Rabban Amri Shabo Hutter Shifto Shabinyamin Loba B'Kahal. That one of the things of Tubav, and you know, this one rabbi says this, that one rabbi said that, and the Rashbam said they're all true, they're not arguing with each other, each one's bringing up a different event, a positive event in some sorts that happened to happen on 15 days and off. So one of them is Rabban Amri Yom Shehuter Shifter Shal Binyamin Lo B'Kahal, that when they allowed the tribe Binyamin back into the Jewish people, Dichsiv Oru Nosein Ish Lo Binyamin. They had said, cursed be the person who gives his daughter to Binyamin, so they wanted them wiped out during the war. And now, Mikra Karva Kirvu, Mikra Karva Rechaku. Actually, it's a bad gear, so it's the other way around. Mikra Karva Rechaku, Mikra Karva Kirvu. They read a pasuk on Tu B'Av. That's what Rishonim say. The suggestion here is a suggestion, that the following historical incident happened. Because this is the Talmud, this rabbinic literature, and they always want to view everything Talmudically. And so, what's the shot? They wanted to wipe them out, and then they allowed them back in. The language of Yom Shehut Bo Hutar Shifta B'Shum Yom Lo B'Kahal, again, I read it. Yom Shebo Hutar Shifta B'Shum Yom Lo B'Kahal, the day that was declared Mutter for the tribe of Yom to go back into Kahal, doesn't exactly sound like the story in the book of Shoftim. That they had regrets and they figured some loophole around it, all the rest of it. That's more like the day they decided not to exterminate Benjamin, but to allow them to survive by surreptitiously giving their daughters to them in an unofficial way so that they would have families and raise children and repopulate the tribe. That's the way you usually would say the story in the book of Shoftim, right? That's how you usually learn it. But here the Lashon is very legalistic. Yom Shabu Hutar Shiftim Yom Makal, that it seems like there was a more than just we curse anyone who gives his child to Binyamin. It's more like we declare them not Jewish. They're not part of Kahal. Like, you know, like Amon Amov or something like that. And more even. And then they changed their mind. They gave a heter. So it sounds like it was a halachic process because this is rabbinic literature. You're looking at Gadot over here in the Yerushalmi. It's in the Mishnah, actually, the language. No, it's not. It's in the Yerushalmi, and it's in the Babli also, in a different way. And sounds like halachic discussions were going on. So how would it be that you could justify that a shevet of Kol Yisrael, who are not mamzerim or anything like that, or osir lovo b'kahal, and then you change your mind, you say they're mutter lovo b'kahal. So they assert this, Rabbanan, here in Yerushalmi, and they say, Mikra Karve Rechaku, Mikra Karve Kirvu, that they read a certain pasuk, because this is the golden age of the Torah Shaval Peh, when there was no Talmud or anything, and therefore you went by the Torah Shaval Peh, which means you read the pasukim and you interpret it a certain way. It was left up to the Bali Masorah of that time to interpret it, Sanhedrin, as we would say. So what happened? On the one hand, it says, Ephraim and Menashe, Keruvim and Shimon Yuli, right? That we all know that Yaakov Avinu said that I'm going to count Ephraim and Menashe like two tribes. Ephraim and Menashe, Keruvim and Shimon Yuli. Hold on for a second. So if that's the case, then we already have more, we have 12 tribes with one to spare. Because it's supposed to be, they had it, Mesorah, in other words. It's supposed to be 12 tribes. You have 13. So one can be spared. And from the conduct of the tribe of Benjamin in the Peleg Shebegiv incident, we see that they don't deserve to live. They're the ones that should be done away with. So we'll have 12 anyway. Even if we wipe out Binyamin, or we halachically declare them pasul kahal because of how they conduct themselves in the plagues we give incident, it's okay because we have Ephraim and Menashe to make up for that. You see? Let me read you the pirush here. Mikra Karsha Yaakov Omar Lefnei Moso Ephraim Menashe Rishimili. Ephraim Menashe will be like two tribes. V'kivon she'ein ela yud bei shvatim, and since all you have is a total of 12, that's the destiny of the Jewish people. Hay she'ephraim Menashe yechashu b'minyan hashvatim tachas Yosef b'shevet Nosef. So Ephraim Menashe will take the place of Joseph plus one. In other words, the Rachel children granted a grand total of two. You hear what I just said? A grand total of two. So Ephraim Menashe, that's two. So forget Binyamin. The key is Shei Binyamin Chata, Kavu, Shua Shevet Anosev, Shei Oseh Brois Lihimachos. So therefore, they figured Binyamin is the tribe that's destined to be wiped out. That's crazy. What that means is, I mean, it's quite a Agadata. What it means is, ever since day one, back in Bereishis time, or at least when they left Egypt, there was like a prophecy of doom. And it was, yes, we have 13 tribes, but one's going to go. By the time it's over, it's going to be a 12. I, Moshe Rabbeinu, took all 13 tribes across the desert. I, Yehoshua ben Nun, led them to the division of the conquest of Eretz Yisrael, more or less, and the division of land. Yeah, but we know it's a ticking bomb. Right? It's a ticking bomb. And it's like a game show, like a sick dog game show. Sooner or later, one of these tribes is going to be destroyed. We don't know which one it is, but one is going to be destroyed because we have 13, and that's too much. Okay? And God in his way, destiny, as we would say, will demonstrate over the future which of the tribes is going to be destroyed and eliminated. And when the Pelegish Begibah incident happened, they said, oh, it's Binyamin. Right? You see from the context of the Benjamin, there the tribes meant to be destroyed. According to this, then it wasn't, if this reading of the story, it wasn't simply berserk fury in the heat of war that led them to exterminate the tribe, but rather they thought in their way of darshaning the psukim. I'm just going to go with the way, I'm giving you the Yerushalmi version here. They thought this tribe deserves to be destroyed. We knew sooner or later we're going to have to exterminate one of us. Isn't that weird? And since they came convinced that it was Binyamin, so that's why they proceeded to kill the men, the women, the children, the behemoths, and all the rest of it, as is written in the book of Shoftim. That's crazy, right? It's like there was a prophecy of doom. And then it gets even more interesting if you throw that into the question, the famous question, how should I put it? Did the chronology-wise, did the story of Pelegish Begibah happen at the end of the time of Shoftim, hundreds of years later after they left Egypt? Or the opposite, did it happen early on, right after the death of Yehoshua ben Nun? The Chazal, the Seder Olam, right? The chronology book from Chazal said it happened right away. In which case, they settled Israel, but they said, there's too many tribes here, and when Binyamin acted the way it is, they wiped it out. Kimat. Alternatively, the way you read it, Pashut in the book, like some of Farsha, I think they're Barbanel, it happened at the end of the book, time of Shoftim, meaning it happened after, Devorah and Shimshon and Gideon and all that stuff, hundreds of years later. In which case, they always had a ticking bomb, which one of us is going to go. It's like we're all in a room, and I know one of us is going to get shot before this Shalashodis is over, before this Chasan is over. Somebody's going to get shot, we just don't know which one. You see? A little bit like the Nun of an Aviyu story, the way Moshe Rabbeinu says, he said, I knew someone's going to go. I knew it was going to be somebody. I just thought it would be you or me, he said to Aaron very famously as a Chazal. We all know that Rashi. So here also, the tribe was waiting. Now, what happened? What made them change their mind? And then Mikra Karu Bekirvu, because Hashem says in Parsha Vayishlach to Yaakovinu, after he wrestles with the battle of with the angel of Esau, right? He says, Goy ukahal goyim yimecha melachim michalitzecha yitzeu. Goy ukahal goyim. You will have a goy and a kahal goyim. So, you could either say like this. a nation and a community of nations, or you could read it very drashadik. You're going to have a goy and kahal goyim, meaning and a dayan lo nola ben yomin. At the time of the battle of Yaakov and Esav, as we know, I mean the sar shel Esav with the angel, but she was pregnant. The ben yomin wasn't born yet, and so when he told him goy kahal goyim yemecha, it goes like this. Kahal goyim are the 12 tribes, and goy is the 13th tribe. That's how they chose to, in their wisdom, to interpret that prophecy. Again, kahal goyim, that's your people. It says yemimecha umlochim michal etzecha yitzeu. So he's talking to Yaakovina, promising him a glorious future in terms of progeny. So kahal goyim came to be seen not as it originally was, the way you and I would read it, goy kahal goyim, but rather technically. Kahal Goyim would be 12 tribes, and Goyim would be an extra tribe who's going to be born, and that tribe was Binyamin Taka. Okay? So then they say like this, oh, so that means Hashem wanted 13 tribes. In which case, we can't wipe out Binyamin. Therefore, we have to come up with some way of circumventing the prohibition, and that's why they ended up, you know, allowing, how should I put it, you know, this circumvention and allowing the tribe Binyamin to repopulate. What does that show you? It was a matter of debate. Many must have said, kill them all. Heck with them. And the Pasuk says, Ephraim, Menashe, Keruvim, Shimon, Gili. And one of them is doomed. And now let's carry that out. And then, according to this Yerushalmi, on Tu B'Av, they said, let's re-look at the Book of Bereishis again. Ah, and I notice it's Goy Kahal Goyim. And that means that we should have 13 tribes and let's leave them alive. It's a good thing they came up with that drasha. Why do I say it's a good thing came up with that drasha? Besides the obvious reasons, today, all Jews, if you're not from Gerim, you're even a Kohen Levi Yisrael. A Kohen's a Kohen, a Levi's a Levi. But what's a Yisrael? From Yehuda Binyamin. Correct? I mean, the other tribes didn't survive. I mean, what I mean by that, they're lost and so on and so forth. With the rarest of exceptions. You know, I mean, it's always possible to have a rare exception, but overwhelming majority of Yisrael comes from Yehuda Binyamin. It's a good thing they didn't wipe out Binyamin. You see what I'm saying? Who knew? Okay? And so it was a close call. It shows you what I said before, that Tisha B'Av represents Machlokes, and Tu B'Av represents repairing Machlokes, but it's not Pashit. A lot of the old bad feelings are still there. I can almost guarantee you, I can't guarantee, but Libi Amrli, which is all I ever have to offer here, that when they let the tribe Binyamin alive, I bet you some people say, that was a mistake. They didn't follow the pasuk. Now I know they said, Goyu Kahal Goyim Yemei Mecha. That's those who followed that. So it's obviously that was the rove of the Sanhedrin, if you want to use technical language, all the rest of it. But I bet you plenty of people say like this, tribe Binyamin shouldn't be alive. We should have wiped them out. And not everybody in Klal Yisrael gave their daughter over. Those that held this way gave their daughter the 400 or 600 girls or whatever it was, you know, to be carried off as wives. I bet you plenty of people say, I guess, don't count me in this. I hold, Reuben, Shimon, Ephraim, Menashe, Reuben, Shimon, Yili. 12 is enough, and this tribe deserves to be extinct. I would imagine, this is just my thought, that later on, when God chooses the first king of Israel from the tribe of Benjamin, Saul, maybe it's Hashem's way of just confirming the psak earlier, especially if you hold it was hundreds of years early at the time of after Yishuv Ben Nun, that, you know, the tribe of Binyamin, it's a good thing they let him live, because I, Hashem, have chosen someone from that tribe. That's my opinion. I've never seen any Pirish explain that. So I hold it's a good word. But, you know, because why Dafka from Binyamin? Because it seems to be that there was a debate here in the Yerushalmi whether Binyamin should be left alive anyway. So even when you repair the Machlokes, you didn't do it entirely. There's still a lot of bad blood left behind. Okay? And same thing when we get to the complicated story of the patrols. You know and I know that, because we've seen in the Gemara and the Medrash, Yoni the Yerushalmi, that Hoshea ben Ela took away the patrols, but nobody went to Yerushalayim because hundreds of years they've been cut off from Judaism, normative Judaism. So he didn't go. And that was considered a big sin, because now you have no excuse not to go. And therefore came the korban of the rest of the 10 tribes of the north. So, yes. So is Tu B'Av a happy day or not a happy day? Meaning, yes, it's a good thing they removed the patrols, and therefore that you no longer had physical impediments to the uniting of Klal Yisrael. But once again, you see, you had no impediments, but it didn't happen. Right? It didn't happen. So, in all three cases, Shehuter, Shvatim, Lo Bezeh Bezeh, and the tribe of Binyamin, and the removal of the patrols, the border patrols, it's good and it's bad. It's good that they removed the barriers, but the Jewish people did not rise to the occasion. That's the Chazal, not me. And that made Hashem angrier and brought a korban. So, Tu B'Av is a happy day, but like I told you before, I'm a pessimist. And so you have to look at everything, I think, realistically, not just with starry-eyed. And I think that's how the Chazal are meant to be understood. And if you think it through, you see, can Humpty Dumpty, all the king's horses, all the king's men, couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again. Can you put Humpty Dumpty together again? You know, can you collect all the eggshells and make it back into an egg the way it was in the first place? It's not so push it. So this, I would say, would be food for thought whenever we come to the theme of Tu B'Av, even though it is a happy day and there's no tachlin. And like I say, that's the day I got married, and many other people have that, that chasana date. And it is a lucky day in this way and that way, but it's complicated. And if the war stopped tomorrow, which it won't, in Gaza, and again, I'm just fantasizing, and all the opposition parties in Israel joined the government, and therefore we have a national unity government, it won't make the bitterness go away. You understand? The junk that we've had with between each other the last couple of years in Eretz Yisrael, the minority would still go on and say, Reuven, Shimon, Ephraim, let's wipe out the opposition. And that's the price of Machlokes. Anyway, on that note, once again, as always, I want to thank Mishpachas Stefanski. And with that, I wish you all a good week.